across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Well, it's getting exciting now. It's not that long until we find out who the next president of the United States is, although at the moment, just a day or so before they start to vote, we have no idea. Butler's got himself off to America. He's been up all night talking to people, and he'll be on the programme this morning. Have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show! My goodness, the American election is exciting, isn't it? Just a day to go now. It's so close, neck and neck, according to the polls. Butler's got himself out to the US. He's covering it for us here in BBC Northern Ireland. You're in Atlantic City, Butler. Good morning.
Yeah, morning to you. Atlantic City, of course, the place where Donald Trump tried to make money and it ultimately all went wrong. He invested in a lot of casinos here that didn't ultimately work out for him. A bit of a gamble in itself, but we are here to talk about the political gamble, and we're travelling across several states, getting a sense of what people are thinking. And I'll tell you what, Stephen, today the focus very clearly on Pennsylvania.
Tell us why in Pennsylvania is so important for those electoral college votes.
Yeah, so basically it's a completely different system of working out exactly who should be president to a system that we might be used to. So essentially they have what is called the Electoral College. Each state has a certain number of Electoral College votes, and they're given those votes kind of on the basis of population. Now, Pennsylvania, it has the most votes for the swing states, those number of states that could go either way, that could go towards Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. They call it, one of the people I spoke to this week said to me that it is the swingiest of swing states. It could go either direction. And to give you a sense of that, it was won by Donald Trump in 2016. It was won by Joe Biden in 2020. And the pollsters believe whoever wins it in 2024 will ultimately take the White House.
We shouldn't presume any knowledge here, Butler, because the way someone becomes the president is different than the states, than for example, here as Prime Minister in the UK. Talk us through this, how it works.
Yeah, so essentially, as I said there, it's broken down into different states. They each have a number of what are known as electoral college votes, and they need to get to this magic number of 270. So there's 50 different states. They all have different numbers of votes. So, for example, California has a significant number of votes because it's such a big state. But it is always going to be won by the Democrats because of the politics in that state. And therefore, you kind of, in a way, discount it. And that's why we go to these swing states, the likes of Wisconsin.
They're called the battleground states, right?
Oh, and they really are battlegrounds. I mean, it's why we are seeing so many rallies. I mean, I know you like to stay up late and watch Donald Trump rally, Stephen, in your darkest hours. And that is very much the case, that he is going and trying to impress those voters on a personal level. And we're seeing that coming up today as well for Kamala Harris. You know the rocky steps? You know those steps where Rocky ran up and down? Well, that is all currently cordoned off in Philadelphia at the Museum of Art there, because Kamala Harris is holding her own rally there tonight. There's talk of Lady Gaga being there, Katy Perry, Oprah Winfrey. It is this big eve of election event in which she is attempting to say, Pennsylvania, I'm here for you. Pennsylvania, I will work for you. And that's really, really important in terms of trying to win people over.
And back to the mechanics, Butler. Let me just make sure we understand this. So if you win that state, these battleground states, by just one vote, you get all the electoral college votes, do you?
Yeah, there are actually two states where it works slightly differently and potentially they could give them. But generally, yes. So for the rest of the states, that is absolutely the case. And you essentially win a state, you win all their electoral college votes. And Pennsylvania, it has a number that means that they really, really want to go there and to try and ensure that they actually get Pennsylvania's votes in the bag. Really, really important for them. Because when you think about it, you know, these different states, you're traveling big distances in order to try and get these votes. And I don't know what you think, but if you've been talking to people in the United States, you probably get a sense and this is what I get a sense of, is that there are huge numbers that have already really made their mind up. They're in the Kamala Harris camp or they're in the Donald Trump camp, and they're not going to be moved one way or another. And there's some pollsters who think it's as little as 2% of undecideds that could potentially make the difference in this election. That's an incredibly small number.
You were in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on Saturday outside a wrestling event, right?
Yeah, so standing outside an AEW collision event, okay? So this was a televised wrestling show going right across the United States. And part of the reason we went there is because there's a lot of people who have been having this conversation about politics beginning to look a little bit like wrestling. We've had Hulk Hogan come out and perform on stage in order to support Donald Trump and Madison Square Garden, which is itself a kind of real mecca for boxing and wrestling.
I think we can hear some of Hulk Hogan, I think.
Well, let me tell you something, Trumpomaniacs. Welcome to the house that Hulkamania built. I don't see no stinking Nazis in here. I don't see no stinking domestic terrorists in here. The only thing I see in here are a bunch of hard-working men and women that are real Americans, brother. You know, when I hear my president and our president, Donald Trump, speak, he sounds for real, brother. He sounds like he has a heart of gold that's all for the USA. But when I hear Kamala speak, it sounds like a script from Hollywood with a really, really bad actress.
So celebrity very much part in both candidates of this election race, Chris.
Yeah, endorsements. That is in some ways the big thing. I already mentioned some of that cast list that is expected for Kamala Harris today as she tries to win those 19 electoral college votes in Pennsylvania. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, those are very big celebrities. And key from them appearing there is not just about giving their back in their support, but it's also just encouraging people to go out and vote. Because this is turning out so tight, actually turnout could be really important. So getting your people out, getting your supporters out, and making sure they get to the ballot box, that's very important.
You've been talking to some people on Saturday night outside that wrestling event. I think they were Trump supporters. Let's have a listen.
Why Trump?
Why? Because he's the best option.
The thing is, listen, out of the last 16 years, 12 of the years has been Democrats, and they've done nothing. Kamala is talking about giving all this money, this aid. It's going to come from taxpayers. You give $25,000 to first-time homebuyers, the houses' prices are going to go up. Inflation goes up.
Build the wall.
You can't be giving all this money out like they've been doing for the last how many years and expect things to get better.
We can't take care of other people without taking care of our own veterans who served in wars. And they get thrown on the side of the road while we put illegals and motels
wars,
and stuff.
Wars that we shouldn't even be fighting in. Wars, the whole point of the war was conquer and power and money.
So you're talking about what's happening at the moment in Ukraine?
In Ukraine, all of that.
You're talking about the Middle East as well?
The Middle East, too. You know, even Palestine, it's sad that Palestine is going, and all of them are fighting over, you know, and it all boils down to, I mean it, it all boils down to religion, good and evil. Good and evil. It's a political agenda. At the end of the day, it's a political agenda.
Although it must be said, when you take a look at political agendas in the U.S., you've got a pair of political agendas that seem to be at each other's throats.
Exactly. Exactly. As far as president and the economy, we need Trump. We need Trump. And they say, well, the economy was not as good as it is now back under Trump. I don't believe that. I really don't. I don't believe that.
Gas wasn't expensive.
Exactly.
Food wasn't expensive.
Exactly.
I'm saying there were housing available. Now there's nothing. I own a business. I own an apparel company. I do a lot of business with companies over in Manchester and UK. They don't go through nothing we go through.
Yeah.
They don't even know.
You know, a country that is built around freedom and the ability to survive and make a living for yourself. It's sad to say, but U.S. is turning into a third world country. It really is. You look at Philly. Look at places.
Is it really, though? Is it?
I think it is. I think it is. Look at the poverty rate. We have one of the highest poverty rates. It's sad.
Listen, you're talking about really important subjects.
Stability.
You're talking about, you know, really important issues that need to be grasped by the American people. I think you're heading into the wrestling show here, aren't
yes,
you?
Sir.
I mean, is there a danger that the political system in America, the way it's been set up, that it is a little bit like a wrestling show in that it's people shouting at each other
and it's entertainment. Yeah. It's sad.
It's actually worse. Trump's gotten shot.
Yeah, it's entertainment, but it's gotten to the point where they're also committing treason. They're committing treason against our own people.
That's a big word.
That's a
treason.
Big one.
Treason's a very
that's
big word.
What's
treason?
Treason is the act of committing crimes against your own people.
And wait, what crimes or what treasons have you committed?
They locked up and charged a sitting president. No president ever in history in America has a has.
Well, he wasn't sitting.
It was former. But he was the charged. Fact that they still went after him. Listen, Trump has been Trump for 20 plus years. They didn't care about Trump 20 years ago. And now they want to say he's a criminal and everything. Kamala Harris has locked up many minorities for petty marijuana charges.
But she's saying she's a black person. She ain't black.
Yes.
There ain't no blacks in her family.
She is black.
No,
she's
not black.
She has black genealogy. But you still have to have at least 35 to 40% black to be.
What does that matter, though?
It doesn't.
And that's kind of what I mean about the politics, where it is people shouting at each other.
It matters to the Democrats because she's using that for the black vote.
Exactly. The politics have made race a problem. Who cares if you're gay? We don't care. Be gay. Be happy, dude. Who cares? But we don't have to pay for your right to be gay.
Kamala Harris is willing to pay for their sex.
We're paying for sex gender. That's not our job as Americans. First of all, taxation is theftation without representation.
Listening to the pair of you, though, it does also give you that sense that, you know, very, very strongly, very, very strongly, that there is a divide in America. Can it be healed?
No.
Yeah, I think it can.
I don't know.
I think it can.
I don't know.
This ain't just politics.
Right, it's not just Trump. It's not even about Trump.
This is about money, power, control.
Could you argue that, though, Donald Trump is about money, power, and control?
Yes, he is. No, he is. I do understand. And he's made a lot of money. But I'll tell you what. We were just talking about this coming up here. Trump has gotten shot. He's the first president I know to go to McDonald's and work. He's doing garbage trucks, dude. This is the first president to actually work a real job. He's doing stuff, and he's trying to connect. He's trying to build community, and they don't want him in office for one specific reason. They don't want him to go against them. And they know he's going to go against
them. Because it's not Kamala and it's not Trump. It's the machine behind them.
And Trump may be evil, but we have to pick the better of the evil, and it's going to be Trump.
It's just astonishing, Buckler. Trump got onto a garbage truck after, of course, Biden had called some of his supporters garbage for, what, 10 minutes, an hour for a photo op, and that guy thinks he's got a real job now.
Beyond that, in McDonald's, it was closed off McDonald's, and they basically had people come up. Apparently, they didn't even order anything. They just got whatever Donald Trump gave them. They didn't actually order the meals. It was just whatever was there. But it shows the power of publicity, and it shows to some extent what Donald Trump is good at in terms of getting out there and selling a story, selling a message. He is a man that is constantly selling, and the product is himself.
If he doesn't win, or indeed if Kamala Harris doesn't win, whichever way this goes, is there a likelihood for this to spill onto the streets? The tension. Listen, in other words, violence.
Well, the problem with saying no to that is that you look back to January the 6th and you recognise that there was a riot at the Capitol, and that was because Donald Trump had fueled, according to lots of investigations and reports, this suggestion that the election had been stolen, that Joe Biden had somehow won a fraudulent election, which of course is not true. And therefore, there are people who are very concerned, particularly about the days after this election. There are people who feel that if Donald Trump doesn't win, he will not accept the result of the vote. And certainly, if you take a look at yesterday's rallies, he was raising these concerns about ballots. He was raising these concerns about whether it was going to be a fair vote. So in an odd kind of way, the path has already been laid for that in the conversations that are being had now by Donald Trump on his stage to supporters. But whether or not it actually happens, given the backlash to January the 6th, given that this has had an impact on people's lives, that's another question. But certainly, if you talk to people here, they don't rule it out.
And is this so close that when you walk along the street, you can feel how close this is? Is everybody talking about how close this is? And does anybody have a clue who's going to win?
Do you know what strikes me about driving around the areas that we've been is that actually there are a number of areas where it is segmented. You will drive into one set of streets and you will see a lot of Kamala Harris sign and an odd Donald Trump sign. And similarly, you will go to other parts and see lots of Donald Trump signs and then just the odd Harris-Walt sign. It feels like America is divided up. And you can almost see it on the streets, because here they do that thing, which you've probably seen in movies, Stephen, that thing of sticking signs on their garden, which says who they are supporting in the election. So you have Trump Vance signs and Harris Walt signs actually sitting in people's gardens, because they regard that as part of their political process. They're showing their support for their candidate. And it segments out different areas in America. But you know, you get into a conversation with people and they are articulate. They are informed. They've been listening to the debate. As you probably will understand, not all of that is necessarily true. There's quite a lot of conspiracy theories being talked about, but they are informed and they want to talk about politics.
I think one of the scary things is you say that when you're driving in the States, your producer Joe Long has relayed back to us just how bad your driving is, Christopher. So we hope you get back safely. You were in church at the weekend.
Yeah. So yesterday, which is still my today because we're now currently at 4:22 in the morning. But yeah, yesterday morning I was in a Sunday service. So I went to this really beautiful historical church in the middle of Pennsylvania. It is in West Philadelphia. It is a church that has stood there since 1792, and it is a really historical church. And when you listen to what was said in the sermon, you get a sense of just how much concern there is, particularly in the African-American community. It is Sunday morning in West Philadelphia, and I'm sitting in a pew in St. Thomas's. This was the first black Episcopal church in the United States, and it is a grand building. There are stained glass windows which honour black saints and bishops. And even though people have gathered here for worship, you do get the sense that they're also talking about politics as well as religion, in a place where the stars and stripes, the American flag, hangs over the pulpit. I see you wearing the I Will Vote t-shirt.
Yes, sir.
This really matters.
Absolutely. We're in the swingiest of swing states, and it's important for all of us to vote. This is where church, state all comes together. We're praying for a successful outcome. We're praying for our country.
It means that much, you think, to be praying for the country?
I'm praying to the point where I'm crying, yes.
The congregation here is split between those dressed for a Sunday and those dressed for election week. There are campaign t-shirts and badges being worn throughout the church, alongside suits and Sunday best hats.
Good morning, St. Thomas.
Good morning.
Ooh, that sounded like passion. Are you voting in person on Tuesday, November the 5th?
Advice on how to vote is a part of this service, a clear sign of how important they view Election Day here. Deborah Camp Fry is one of the wardens of the church.
I think this is a primal response, that people are very concerned about their own survival. I mean, there have been signposts in the elections that I think is particularly troubling to African Americans. And I think other populations within the country that are concerned that we might be isolated further, disenfranchised economically, and certainly even from a political standpoint, that we might be losing our voice.
Donald Trump says that he wants to reach out to black voters. Donald Trump says that black voters support him.
But at the same time, at his rallies, you're hearing the sound of Dixie playing in the background and the Confederate flag waving. So I think that that's doublespeak.
Although those may be his supporters. That's not Donald Trump himself.
But he's not disavowing them.
The service itself is far from downbeat. There are people who fear a return of Donald Trump, but they are keeping faith, and that includes the minister of St. Thomas's, the very Reverend Canon Martini Shaw.
The word love has been used so loosely during this campaign season. In fact, one candidate recently used it following a big rally in New York City's Madison Square Garden. He called that rally a love fest, fueling hatred and division. That's not love. Encouraging chaos and violence. That's not love. Promoting racism and division. That's not love. I can't tell you who to vote for, but I am personally voting for the person who loves this nation and wants to protect its democracy and constitution.
Who is elected to the White House will really affect the lives of generations to come. Supreme Court, other judges that will be appointed, it's a very important election.
Are you worried about the election?
Oh, I'm very worried and I'm very prayerful. Not only is it an important election, I think, for America, it's an important election for the world due to the strength of America around the world. I pray my birthday, which is Wednesday, I pray I'm waking up on my birthday celebrating the fact that we have elected a new president who's going to bring this nation together and not bring us further apart.
Church itself is intended as a celebration, and among the prayers being said are some for the next generation. When children enter the church from Sunday school, they're wearing pro-vote t-shirts and carrying signs encouraging people to go to the ballot box.
Yeah, so for the kids today in our church school, we read a book on voting and how to be a confident leader.
Tanisha Wilson helps teach the children.
I am myself a black woman, and I think that being able to just see a black woman running for president and have a likelihood of winning for president shows a lot about the importance of representation. I'm also Miss Philadelphia, and so I am the 8th black Miss Philadelphia. So being another portion of history and just being able to show little black girls that, you know, you can do anything you put your mind to. So it's a big election this year.
And the kids. What about the kids? What do they think about this election?
So I've had kids tell me that they're stressed out by the election. Like,
really?
I had a 6-year-old tell me that she is stressed about this election. And so it's so funny to think that you have kids that can't vote, right? And these emotions are trickling down into them. And so I think that it's important that we do have a conversation around democracy and around voting, that it doesn't have to be something that is scary. It doesn't have to be something that is intimidating. And it doesn't have to be something that we should run away from. It should be something that we are happy to do as citizens of the United States.
Patriotism feels a part of all American life. In church, they make a point of giving thanks for the country. Yet sometimes it feels that America is not one nation but two. And that split is likely to be on show this week between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
That's Chris Buckler reporting for us this morning. 4:30 in the morning over there. We'll let him get to bed. Here's the number, 030-30-80-55-55 is our number this morning as you look at this presidential election. Are you going to sit up and watch it and listen to it? Who's it going to be, Trump or Harris? Who do you want it to be? We'll pause there. Let's get the news at 9:30. The American journalist Tom Rivers joining us this morning. Good morning to you, Tom.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. It's razor wire close, isn't it?
Certainly looks that way. With the caveat, think back when the major networks, decades ago, were very, very good at polling and debate outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. We live in a different world where social media takes the fore in many regards. Nowadays, people get their information from different places this time around. Think back to 2016, the polling had Trump underrepresented. 2020, the worst underrepresentation of any candidate ever. Now, have they put that weighting in to the current polls, or are they using the same old methodology? I'm not sure, but we'll find out, I guess, within 24 hours.
And these two candidates, they couldn't differ anymore. And so is your country completely divided? And after this result, who's going to unify it? Is it even possible to unify it?
Well, let's go back. 4 years ago, when Biden won, day one, he says, I'm here to unify the country. Day two, he didn't do that and hasn't done that for 4 years. So we keep hearing that mantra from both sides. How effectively they can do that, whoever wins, big, big question mark indeed.
And do you think, I'm already reading some reports of Trump's campaign claiming that there's already election interference, election fraud. Are we going to have all of that over again?
We may well do. It would be great, Stephen, if we talked, say, Wednesday morning and said, you know, candidate A won, candidate B won. This is the world we're going to be walking into for the next 4 years. We may well be talking Thursday, Friday into the next week as well, because it's going to boil down to, just as you well know, 7 swing states. Maybe there could be large contentious results in one or two of them. We could be hung up on the rocks for weeks, if not months, if in fact that's the case.
In terms of foreign policy, you've got obviously the war in Ukraine. How will each of these candidates differ in how they deal with it? In other words, how is it going to affect us in this part of the world?
Kamala Harris kind of is saying, yep, I agree with everything Biden did. You know, I keep throwing money at Ukraine for as long as it takes. $35 trillion in debt right now in the U.S. You cannot service that forever. Donald Trump comes in and says, look, we are going to support Kyiv for the, you know, certainly for the interim short period of time, and then knock some heads together, get them in places like Geneva and say, lock you in a room till you get some kind of a result coming out of it. Think back to Minsk II. That kind of solved the whole problem. Many years ago, that was thrown away by people like Victoria Nuland. So, yes, a very, very different situation when it comes to things like funding foreign wars with regard to the two candidates.
And finally, Tom, for those people who look at Kamala Harris and say, well, you've been in power for 4 years. You've been the vice president, for goodness sake. How is she promising to deliver new things if she's been at the top for so long now?
I think the answer is in your question. She says she's turning the page. Well, why didn't you turn the page 4 years ago? I think it's a legitimate question. Also, you have to look at things like, ultimately, as Bill Clinton once said famously, it's the economy, stupid. And the cost of living is going up for everybody. That's going to be a major factor. Other side of the coin, abortion rights. The Democrats get a knockout punch on that one due to Trump saying, look, it's up to each individual state. And, of course, the border, she was a border czar, very, very ineffective in that regard. That may have some impact as well. So it's going to be, you know, people are going to line up. And we've been hearing it repeatedly now. Most women are voting for Harris. Most men are voting for Trump. How about this? Families get together. They say, we don't want to cancel our votes out. They sit around a kitchen table. They say, which candidate lines up with most of the things they support or want to see? And that is really influential. Nobody's talking about that interpersonal communication within families.
Tom, thank you very much. Morning to you. Let's come back home and local news now. The PSNI are increasing patrols in Londonderry after two women were targeted at knife point in sexually motivated attacks at the weekend. On Friday night, a woman was punched by a man and pulled into nearby trees before being pushed to the ground at knife point in Drumahoe Park. She was able to strike the attacker with her torch before running for help. The second attack happened during broad daylight on Saturday afternoon at the top of Hill Park in the waterside area of the city. The police say a woman was approached by a man armed with a kitchen knife. He grabbed the woman, but he ran off when she swung her dog lead at him. Detectives are investigating whether the same man was behind both crimes, but they have ruled out any connection with two previous assaults on women that happened in the city last week. Chief Superintendent for Derry City and Strabane, Gillian Kearney, spoke to Radio Foyle's Northwest today.
On Friday evening at around 10 p.m, a woman in her 20s was walking in Drumahoe Park in the city when a man approached her from behind. She has managed to get free from him. He was at knife point. She has struggled with her attacker. She's managed to strike him in the face a number of times, break free and run for help. Police immediately responded to the area and searched for the attacker who have fled the scene. We received a further report then on Saturday afternoon of an attack on a woman in her 40s at the top of the Hill Park area. She was walking her dog shortly before 3 p.m. when she was approached by a man armed with a knife, a kitchen knife. He has grabbed at the woman, but she's called out, swung at him, prompting him to run off. Again, we had a quick response to the area and conducted a really thorough search. However, the attacker had left the area. We are investigating the possibility that both these attacks may be linked, and we do have a description of a suspect that we are interested in any information in relation to. He is described as a white male in his 20s, around 5 foot 10 tall, with slim to medium build, and wearing all dark clothing, hooded top and bottoms. At this point in time, there have been no arrests.
These two attacks are recent. They happened over the weekend, but we had other attacks recently in the past week or so as well. What's your message to women today?
Yeah, we understand, you know, that these attacks will have real concern in the local community with a second attack of this kind in just 2 days. However, I want to reassure people that we do have a focused patrolling plan, including high visibility, increased police presence in key areas such as our local parks and the city centre, and that will continue over the coming days. What I can say is that the two incidents reported from the weekend before are not connected, we believe are not connected to these two recent incidents. We have across Derry City and Strabane experienced a reduction in our violence against women and girls incidents. But what is of particular concern is how unusual these two incidents reported at the weekend are. So I am appealing for information to anyone who may have any information or been in these areas on Friday night and Saturday afternoon to get in touch with us, no matter how small you might think that piece of information is, and please do get in touch with us.
Well, let's speak to Elaine Crory this morning from Women's Resource and Development Agency. Good morning to you, Elaine.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, look, there is a fear in the local area. The police trying to establish if these attacks are indeed connected. What about the general feeling with women in Northern Ireland and how safe they are at night time?
Well, I think and these attacks demonstrated it, and the fact that although the PSNI are saying these two might be linked, there were other attacks in the city last week that they say are not linked. So it demonstrates pretty clearly that it's not just that women and girls don't feel safe, it's that they aren't safe. And you might be safe on an individual day or an individual night, but you never know when the moment will come. And that is the reality that I think we've been dealing with on an individual level and to some degree on a community level for decades, really, if we're honest. And I think it's time that we start talking about it more and trying to deal with it on a community level a bit more coherently.
Well, talking about more, Elaine, means that, you know, a man like me shouldn't be afraid to ask the question, and which is this. Are you really saying, and are women really saying, and I'm asking this as an open question, I'm not being critical, that no matter what the area is in Northern Ireland, women are afraid to go out? Surely there are safer areas than others, are there not?
I mean, you never know. The thing is this, if you never know on any given day whether that will suddenly become an unsafe area. You know, I don't know, I can't speak at these cases, but it's likely, I mean, thinking about the woman who was walking her dog, it's likely that that's the route she walked her dog all the time and felt like it was the best route to walk her dog in. And this is the thing, a lot of us know that, like, you might be safe on Monday and you might be safe on Tuesday, but you don't know what's going to happen on Wednesday. It's not about necessarily the physical area. It's about the look, for want of a better word, of whether or not a person who wants to target women chooses that place on that day.
Cara Hunter, the SDLP MLA, has submitted a question to the Justice Minister asking Naomi Long what her permission is on carrying pepper spray in your bag, in your pocket, as a defence. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the legalities of that are. My understanding is that it's not legal, and I understand that Cara Hunter is asking for clarity on that. And I can see why. I can see why that would help people feel, you know, maybe a little bit more secure. I noticed some of the things that people did use to try and get away from their attacker include things like the lead for their dog. And that is not a position, really, we should be putting women in to try and keep themselves safe by keeping things like pepper spray on them, which could, in the wrong hands, and with bad luck, again, it could be used against you as well. I really think that, you know, people will start to do things like that just to feel safe, because ultimately, you know, people have to get around. You know, they can't be confined to a house. We have to get to and from work. We have to get to and from university or school or wherever it is we have to go in life. Never mind things like just being outside for leisure or for your own time and your own mental health. And so people will have to make choices at some point. And it's inevitable that people will make their own choices, whether that's necessarily legal or illegal, such as pepper spray, to get about. And that's not a situation we want to be in.
Elaine, thanks very much. Morning to you. 03030 80 55 55. What's it like then, as a female walking around the different parts of Northern Ireland, being out and about at night time? 03030 80 55 55. If you're a parent, does this place feel safe, wherever it is you live in Northern Ireland? If you're teenagers, your 20-year-old children are out and about, and it's not just young people we're talking about here, is it? So you can give us a sense. 03030 80 55 55. Now, thought-provoking interview coming up next. Clodagh Dunlop was only 35 when she had her stroke, which left her with locked-in syndrome in 2015. She was alive, she could hear and see everything going on around her, but she could not move. She is campaigning for a treatment for stroke, a thrombectomy. It's a time-critical procedure, and she's campaigning for it to be available 24/7. This is a procedure where clots are plucked straight from the brain, and it can save patients from severe disability or death. Currently, it's only available between 8 and 5. And that means, campaigners say, there's a lottery of care if you suffer a stroke. Here's Clodagh. I started by asking her about her stroke.
In 2015, I had a series of TAAs, and then ultimately on Easter Monday 2015, I took a massive brainstem stroke, which left me rehabilitating in hospital for almost 8 months.
You had locked-in syndrome, didn't you?
I did, which is pretty much a nightmare scenario where you're trapped in your own body. So you're conscious, you can think, you can feel, but you can't move a single muscle in your body.
What's that? Can you begin to describe what that feels like?
Do you know, it really is your worst nightmare, probably the most horrific thing I've ever experienced. Sometimes I describe it as being buried alive, but even then you could probably make a sound, perhaps like an astronaut detached from your spaceship. It was really terrifying.
And you could hear people presumably around you talking about you?
I could hear everything around me. I could see everything. I could hear people chatting about whether I was going to survive, my prognosis, potentially that I may die from overheating, what wards I would be moved to if I were to get well enough to move to out of intensive care. So it was definitely a very frightening experience.
And when you tried to move, you just, nothing would move. Is that what the sensation was or what?
There were so many times I wanted to move. I often describe when I woke in ICU that it felt like the incubating tube was pressing my tongue so hard onto my teeth that I may sever my own tongue off. And I wanted to scream. I wanted to move and shout at people and say, please move that tube. I remember there were times I was so hot and I just wanted to scream out, would somebody get me a fan? And there were so many little things, like even my hair tickling my face. As you can imagine, as a woman, if your hair is tickling your face, your instinct is just lift your arm up and flip it away. But here I was lying, your hair would tickle your face, you would feel the sweat rolling down your neck, but there was absolutely nothing you could do to make it any better for yourself. You just had to lie and endure it.
And were you screaming inside?
In my head, I was screaming so loudly. You know, I suppose I can only describe it as I was the same person as I was before. So I was wanting every part of me to scream out. I was willing my body to make noise, but there was nothing. Absolutely nothing.
My goodness. And how did you get out of this state?
I was completely conscious the whole time, so I was aware of everything that was going on around me. And sometimes I think it was a build-up of being frustrated and angry about not being able to move my hair, not being able to adjust my position. And it was a culmination of all those emotions and the fact that my family and friends were standing around me that just kick-started my brain. It was like a firework. And my best friend had made me so angry that suddenly I started to make a noise and move my hand. And I think it was just like my brain suddenly jump-started. But the movement was nothing significant. It was only a wrist about half a centimetre.
It's just a horror picture. Do you get flashbacks of all of that? Like, how can that ever leave you, that experience?
Do you know what? I don't. I'm very blessed. I say I was surrounded by love. The hospital staff were fantastic. My family and friends were fantastic. So as much as the illness was horrific, I can only say of my experience that I was surrounded by love and support from in my local community. So in many ways, out of something horrific, I felt an outpouring of love.
Well, look, you were just 35 when you had your stroke, and you're campaigning now for the health minister to help others with a clot-busting procedure. Tell us about this.
When I had my stroke in 2015, it happened around 2 a.m. and I didn't have a surgery till around 10 a.m. and I felt very angry. Everyone knows the acronym ACFAST. And I couldn't understand why I'd had a major clot release into my brain, slowly kill my brain, but I didn't have the surgery until 10 a.m. And I learned then that that surgery wasn't available at that time in the evening. It was only available 9 to 5. And I realized
no matter what the results of that, the impact of that is on the person at critical time, it's only available 9 to 5, like when a shop opens and closes.
Yeah, and that totally blew my mind. How was a surgery that saved my life only available 9 to 5? It's now available 8 to 6. But for me, I was so angry. There was discussions about turning off life support. And if I did survive, I would be severely disabled. And for me, it's very simple. If that surgery was available 24/7, it would save lives. Everyone
This is
knows,
down to resource, isn't it? It's down to money.
It's simply down to money. But for me, I know the cost of the surgery is much less than if you end up, like myself, with significant disabilities. I spent 8 months in hospital, which has its expenses, ongoing rehabilitation, medication. So the cost of the surgery would pay for itself. But
so you would have had fewer disabilities, would you, had you had your surgery earlier?
Neurologists tell me now, if I had that surgery in a timely fashion, I would have left hospital within a day with probably very little wrong with me and returned to work maybe within a week.
And what disabilities do you have now, Clodagh?
So I have significant right side weakness. I wear carbon fibre splints. I struggle with my speech, my swallow. Many people with stroke are emotionally labile. So there's quite a lot going on, but it doesn't stop me enjoying life. But the surgery would prevent that happening to other people.
So what do you say to the Health Minister, finally?
I say, please introduce that surgery 24/7. Ultimately, it will save lives. It will save damage to people's brains, and it will prevent disabilities.
Clodagh, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you, Stephen.
Well, the Department of Health are saying, look, it costs us over £5 million a year of recurrent funding. In other words, you need that every year for these specialised procedures. They're carried out, they say, by highly skilled teams in a small number of hospitals across the UK. Alan Stout, Dr. Alan Stout, Chair of the BMA. Morning, Alan.
Good morning, Stephen.
And yet the consequences of someone not having this is that they cost the NHS a lot of money because of the damage that the stroke and not getting it sorted in a timely manner will mean to the NHS long term.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I mean, like so many instances like this, I mean, I can get nowhere near describing this as well as somebody like Clodagh, who has lived experience and has been through it all. And I think she summed it up perfectly. It covers so many actual key basic principles. This is an invest to save. The evidence base is all there for this being a successful intervention. And that's why it's done already, although it's only done during working hours. But also the rest of the UK, significant other parts of the UK have accepted the evidence base for the 24/7. Dublin actually as well has accepted the evidence base for 24/7. And you're right, it has a direct impact on people, first and foremost, in terms of their recovery from stroke. But it also has an economic benefit as well. And the estimates are that you save nearly 3 times as much as you actually invest.
And the Department of Health telling us that, look, this is time-critical surgery. It's available in the Royal Victoria Hospital Monday to Sunday, 8 to 5. Look, because I'm not trying to be facetious about this. Strokes happen at any time. So why is there this 8 to 5 model? Like, why is the shop shut after 5 o'clock?
Yeah, I mean, again, the evidence is quite clear on this. The intervention needs to happen within 6 hours for you to get the really successful outcomes. And those are those life-changing outcomes. And actually, the outcome reduces by around 4% for each hour of delay. I think the Stroke Association had figures. I mean, let's not take away from some positives in this. This is an exceptionally good service. In Belfast, there's over 100 procedures per year. but they're probably stroke association figures show that they're probably only getting about half of the ones that that they could and should be getting. But again, it comes down to basic principles. To deliver this 24/7, we need to invest in staff. What we've been saying over and over and over again, we don't have the staff to deliver it. We also need to invest heavily in services. We also need to get on top of the prevention agenda, because we could be preventing these by other means and preventing a significant number.
But it's
also about the reform, Stephen, about how we try not to deliver too much in too many centres.
But when, Alan, this surgery is available 8 till 5, could we not have are the surgical team flat out? Or could we not have a team of surgeons on call for a window of time so that they're available outside normal hours if that's when the strokes that day happen? Or is this team flat out?
No, of course. I mean, that's exactly how you would do it, just like you run any other emergency service. But to run an on-call rota like that 24/7 needs staff. I mean, you can't simply be asking staff to work 24 hours a day. You need to have a rota of staff, and so often staff is what we're missing, and this is what we need to invest
but people,
and make sure that we're training enough staff and retaining the staff that we have.
I've got to go back to the question, though, because there are many different professions where people are on call. So, yeah. In other words, in any day, they're on call in case they're needed. So have we got a model here, Alan? And look, I genuinely don't know. It's why I'm asking. Where some of these surgeons could be sitting and they don't do anything between 8 and 5. And then if there is a stroke patient that needs this operation, say 2 hours later, they're not available. They've done their day's work and they haven't treated anyone. Or how does this work?
No. These are highly specialist people who are needed for multiple interventions and multiple investigations and multiple treatments. So they will be exceptionally busy, and the stroke service will be part of their workload. But to develop a 24/7 rota, you can't just simply say, well, we've only got a small number of interventional radiologists or the ones that are involved in this. We have a small number, and what we'll do is we'll just work them 24 hours a day. We need more of them. It's as simple as that if you're going to populate a 24/7 rota. And it does come back down to workforce. If we're going to provide these excellent services and we're going to provide them as best as we can, we need the workforce to support them.
I think Clodagh, you're right, did sum it up. The frustration that she has on behalf of many people. Imagine having life-changing disability and knowing in the back of your head that you were available to be in the hospital on time. You could have got there, but there was just nobody to do the operation, and therefore you're left with life-changing brain injury.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I cannot kind of emphasize it enough. I mean, this is people. This is people's lives. This is people's survival. Again, don't we've got to be careful. This isn't every single stroke is appropriate for a thrombectomy. It's about 10% of the total number of strokes. There are other interventions. But it is, and this is where the minister in particular is pushing the reform agenda. We need to make sure that we have our services. We have excellent services and world-class services in a smaller number of areas so that we can start to address some of these issues like a 24/7 thrombectomy service.
Okay, Alan, thank you. I can see people calling us whose children have had strokes. They themselves have had strokes. 0303 80 55 55. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC, and the 10 o'clock news is coming up right now. Good morning, 5 past 10, 0303 80 55 55. Don't forget, if you've got a story, send it into the BBC via the Nolan email, nolan@bbc.co.uk. That's where Alan got in touch with this morning. Alan.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. And you emailed us from Belfast International Airport yesterday. What's going on?
Oh, for goodness sake. It was just shambolic, you know, really what I went into there yesterday. You know, there's six operating lanes at the departures security, and only two of them were operating. And people were panicking, saying, how am I going to get through this? This queue's not moving. Their gates were shutting, like, you know. So I was caught up in that. Chris Morgan, who played for Linfield and Glentoran and a few other Irish League teams, he was trying to get to the Spurs match yesterday. So him and his son, they ended up bumping the queue at the very last minute, and they only just got there.
They were probably brought up for a late-minute flight, weren't they? Have they not just done that airport up recently?
I believe they have, but obviously it's not fit for purpose, you know, the way it's being operated, because people were missing flights all over the place there yesterday.
Oh, were they? They were actually missing flights?
I think quite a few did. Staff was running around sort of going, no, it's not my fault, it's not my fault, and people were going, what's keeping here, you know? And
Point of having six lanes if you've only got two open?
Exactly. They were sitting there empty, you know, and then like I said, I went and brought my phone out, and no one was wanting to take a photo, and was wanting to, you know, and then some member of security was saying, put that away, no cameras, no phones out here, and this, that, and the other. There's all the exit. It was just ridiculous, you know, really. And it ended up costing me £103 for, you know, like, the following flight to Newcastle.
Oh, you missed your flight?
I missed my flight. I actually got to gate 14 at Belfast International, and there was another guy running there behind me, and we were told. And then we ended up asking, okay, what do you do here? Like, do we just get the next flight? See that, Alexa, I need to get out of the way here.
But you
see,
Alexa, I can't hear Alexa. Never mind Alexa.
I'm going into this other room. But I was asking, what do you do here?
And they made you pay for it.
Yeah, I'm saying, you just had to pay for the next flight. So anybody going to a far off place could have been told, well, you need to pay it.
Where were you flying to, Alan?
Newcastle upon Tyne.
How ahead of time were you at the airport?
I was there in time. I was there, like, it says, it gives you advice. They advise 2 hours before, you know. So basically, I was there, but
2 hours before.
Yeah. So it basically wasn't moving. It was just whenever I got up the escalator to go to the departure security, it was just random people.
But why?
It was two names. Well, it's Sundays and Mondays are very busy, seemingly. But some of the staff right now were at a loss, you know, why is this, you know, in the sense, and people were complaining, and that was the general mood in the place. And some people were having meltdowns. They thought they weren't going to get their flight.
I travelled back and forward to Los Angeles quite a lot, and the Los Angeles airport, you can arrive 2 hours before your flight to fly to the UK. And it's pretty seamless most of the time in LAX. So yeah. 2 hours gets you checked in, all of that kind of stuff. I do it quite a lot, never had a problem. 2 hours at the international airport, you can't fly Newcastle to Belfast, in your experience.
Yeah, I mean, this year was like a caterpillar. You know, it was like, you know, beep, beep, you know, a couple of steps every, you know, and people turn around looking at me, going, what's keeping this, you know?
Let's see if other people have had a similar experience. We've been in touch with Belfast International yesterday. We haven't heard back from them yet. When we do, we'll bring it to you. And thanks for bringing the story to us, Alan. Thank you very much, sir.
No problem. You're welcome.
Thank you. Morning.
Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Morning to you, Kieran and Dungannon. Morning, Kieran.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Stephen, just a brief point. I was wondering, following the Assembly receiving an additional £1.5 billion, I think, from the Treasury, would they review their decision in relation to winter payments for pensioners?
So with this extra money, so Northern Ireland has got more money from the Labour Party, from government, sorry, yeah, from the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, than we expected. So you're saying with that extra money, should Stormont review, change their decision on the cold weather payments for pensioners.
Yes, that's right.
That's a really interesting question. We'll put it to them.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you, Kieran. Edward and Lauren. Morning, Edward.
Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning. Oh, here's another. Hold on a minute. Here's another punter contacting us. Stephen, we had the same problem last Friday at the International Airport. Two security lanes going instead of six. So much for the new security system. There was a person at the lane that said they simply had no staff to open the rest. The queue was right down to the stairs. What's going on at the International Airport? What is the point of having six lanes if only two of them are open and people are bunged down the stairs? Sorry, Edward. Back to the stroke story.
That's okay. No, I'll tell you, Stephen, what I was saying. We have ambulance service on. Our ambulance service works 24/7, right?
You what?
The ambulance service is available 24/7.
Yes.
So why not have this situation? No, as the guards getting the advertise on the TV and that to get a stroke treated as quickly as possible.
That's right.
But it doesn't make sense to you. You'd have to be inside between 8 o'clock and 5 o'clock to get treated. So
now remember, this procedure for a stroke, as Dr. Alan Stout was telling us, that this is only 10%. Of the stroke procedure. So this isn't every stroke, and Dr. Stout from the BMA was emphasising that to us. But look, it is a concern, nevertheless.
You know, at the end of the day, the sooner the stroke is treated, the better.
That's right.
And as Clodagh has outlined as well, it's less expense to the NHS if it's treated in time.
I was in a restaurant last week in Newton Ards, and there was this, you could just tell the love between the two of them. There was a daughter out with her elderly mother.
Yeah.
And her mother, I know this because I overheard the conversation. The elderly lady was in her 90s, and there was mum sitting talking, no problem, to daughter. And then all of a sudden, we looked over, and daughter was on the phone to 999. The lady was unresponsive, and her face had slumped down. She wasn't moving panically. She was just non-responsive, sitting there, and it was horrible to watch. It was really, like, I nearly started crying. And the paramedics were there within minutes. Like, they were there really, really quickly. Yeah. Edward, I hope that lady's all right. Actually,
she at the end of the day, and that's why all the more. I'm speaking sort of way to help Clodagh to bring the point across, like, you know, to make this, to have this treatment available 24/7. Surely that's going to happen to any of us, Stephen.
Absolutely, 100%, 100%.
And I'm not just thinking of myself; I'm thinking of others. Like, you know what I mean? If you only can get treatment from 8 o'clock to five, sure, it's not good enough. Surely it's not good enough.
How old are you, Edward?
I'm 77.
And have you had to use the NHS recently?
I'm having health problems myself, and you know, but nothing serious. You know what I mean. But at the same time, I realise my age, and I realise, you know, I'll tell you for example. Do you see if a person has high blood pressure?
Yeah,
that can lead into all sorts of things. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
High blood pressure can lead to what I call, and I know two friends of mine have died from it, bleeding in the brain.
Oh.
And the bleeding in the brain can kill you. And yet, and you know how it happens? It happens whenever high blood pressure is not being treated. So you have to keep an eye, and high blood pressure runs in some families. And that's why, you see, and that can lead to, you see, high blood pressure can lead to a stroke. Are several things,
mm-hmm.
And that's why I said, and the key to have that service available, as I would say, it's a priority. That's why I would feel about it. You know, what I mean, I'm not just thinking of myself, thinking of other people. That's why this morning I'm ringing into, I'm thinking of Clodagh here, and she's campaigning, and I would support her campaign to help the health minister, Michael. You know what I mean,
Mike Nesbitt.
To get this, to get this in place.
So I know, Edward, that you're on talking about strokes today, but just that question on a separate matter that our listener brought up a matter of moments ago, saying, look, we've had this $1.5 billion, we've had more money into Northern Ireland than we expected to get. Should Stormont review again their decision to cut the winter fuel payments for pensioners? What do you think?
No, I think to cut the winter fuel payments, no, I think that, No, I don't. I think all pensioners should get it.
Well, look, we'll ask the Department of Finance if they've any plans to review that. Thank you for your call today. Thank you, Edward. Morning
Thank
to
you.
You.
Thank you.
Good Big morning. Questions for the Royal Family now after this Channel 4 Dispatches programme. It was also an investigation by the Sunday Times and Sunday Mirror, joint investigation. It accused the Prince of Wales of letting out properties with damp and mould issues that don't meet minimum standards for landlords. William was confronted by Lord John Bird, founder of The Big Issue. It also suggested that the King is renting out his property to the likes of the NHS and others for millions and millions of pounds. Jenny Bond, Royal Commentary, give me this reaction after watching the documentary.
Yeah, I've just finished watching it, and I must say, I think it was a very comprehensive and powerful examination of the finances of the Duchies of Cornwall and Lancaster, which provide William and Charles, the sovereign, with a great deal of their income. And I think it's going to be extremely uncomfortable watch, actually, for both the King and for the Prince. I've studied all of this over the years, and of course I knew that these two duchies provided a lot of wealth for the royal family, or for those two key members, and they use much of it for the duties they carry out, but also for their private income. But I didn't know, really, that they charged what appears to be a commercial rent for example, NHS facilities, for charities to have some of their headquarters, for the army to train on Dartmoor, because they own Dartmoor, for the navy to moor boats at Plymouth, at what appeared to be commercial rents. To me, that's pretty extraordinary. It doesn't sit very happily with the image we have of both Charles and William.
Why is it extraordinary, Jenny, if they own it?
You would think that certainly for the NHS and for charities, they would at least have a peppercorn rent or a reduced rent. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but they appear to be commercial rents, according to the documentary. I don't find that it sits very well with what I believe to be two men who care passionately about the world, about society, and about the environment.
So does this make you question that?
Well, it does to an extent, yes. I mean, there was very uncomfortable juxtapositions of William talking about his Earthshot project to try to save the planet, to try to have sustainable projects and fund them, which is a wonderful project. But that was juxtaposed with the mining that's going on in Cornwall on his land, and dynamite blasting areas of great beauty apart, and people saying, you know, I wish that Buckingham Palace was sited next to one of these mines, and they had to live with the fumes and the dust and the pollution. It did not sit happily with me.
How damaging is this?
I think it will blow over like the dust, I suppose. And there have been questions about royal finances before. I just found this one particularly powerful because of what we know about the character of these two, and also coming right after the budget, when so many people are going to be paying more capital gains tax, and there's a lot of questions about corporation tax. Now, both of these duchies are exempt from those taxes. The palace say that's because they are private estates, but they're run on a commercial basis. It's a pretty thin line they're treading, I think.
And how sensitive is King Charles, Jenny, do you think?
Well, I think he's extremely sensitive. I think he's very sensitive, and I've always been led to believe, and I do believe, that he's a decent landlord. And you know, with all that he's got in his life, he can't oversee every single tenant. And I think it said one, I think it said something like one out of six of the properties of the Duchy of Cornwall had been found to be below the energy efficiency level to make them almost illegal, and that it was damp and mold and everything. But you can do a lot with statistics. That does mean that five out of six are absolutely fine. But I think the King would be dismayed to learn, if he did not know, and probably he should know, that some of his properties are possibly not even fit for human habitation, and certainly below efficiency standards.
And what about this news about Prince Andrew?
Yeah, that's a long time coming. I think the King's patience has finally run out with his younger brother, and he has stopped in the past few months, apparently, the allowance that a personal allowance has given his little brother of about £1 million a year. And also, he's not going to pay the security costs for guarding the Royal Lodge, where Andrew is lodged and refuses to budge, despite much pleading. So basically, he's turning the screws on Andrew's finance, and Andrew now has to decide whether he can pay the extremely large costs of running a 30-room mansion, or can he pay them himself, or he's going to have to get out and do what his brother has been saying for a long time, move to a beautiful property, namely Frogmore Cottage, which Harry and Meghan had done up at a cost of £2.4 million. And that's just the refurbishment. I mean, more money than most people could ever dream of. But Andrew doesn't seem to feel that it suits his needs or perhaps his status.
How much would Andrew, obviously you don't know precisely, but is he wealthy? Like, does money not matter to him?
No one seems to know where he gets his money from. Obviously, he would have inherited some from his mother and from his grandmother. But he always appears to be fairly, what we hear, fairly strapped for cash. He has a very small pension from his time in the military. But there are reports that he thinks he can finance this large property by some kind of commercial activity or connections he has from when he was a trade envoy for the UK, connections he made then. But you have to make sure they're decent, shall we say, connections, respectable connections, because there's a reputation of his brother at stake here as well as his own.
And does the King and Prince Andrew, do they talk?
Yes, they talk, and I think there is a brotherly respect, possibly love, certain affection. Charles includes
some brotherly
him.
Love from the King, cutting off £1 million a year. How's both brotherly about that?
Well, you know, a man in his 60s, should he really be looking to, as it was his mother, and now to his brother to finance his life? I mean, is that what he should be doing? And in this new, this is all coming from Robert Hardman, who is a very well-connected royal correspondent. And he has learned a very well-sourced report that the Queen was going to do the same thing, that had she lived a bit longer, she would have told Andrew, you have to get out of Royal Lodge. It's not sustainable. I think the King is aware that it's not a good look, is it, to have your brother, to have a royal duke, a duke swanning around in this great big place, riding his horse about, spending his time, as we hear, watching aircraft land and take off on a big screen in his house, because that's what he likes to do. I mean, it's simply not. It smacks of the idle aristocratic rich, although he isn't rich enough really to carry on this lifestyle, I don't think.
Jenny Bond, always good to talk to you. Thank you, Jenny. Now, last up this morning, it was a special night for the Northern Ireland women's football team in Windsor last week as they overcame Croatia to keep their Euro 2025 dreams alive. Simone McGill, who captained the side for the first time at Windsor Park, is back in Northern Ireland tonight for a coaching initiative driven by the IFA sponsor. As part of the initiative, Simone will be going back to her first club, Middlesbrough Ladies, reunite with her brother, who first got her into football, to highlight the importance of sporting role models and what they have on the local community. Good morning, Simone.
Good morning.
Proud moment for you then?
Yes, very, very much so. Obviously getting to lead the country out, obviously was a big, massive dream of mine as a kid. So to kind of get that moment last week was really special for me.
And when you were a child, did you have dreams of being a footballer?
Yes. When I was four, I first started playing, and I kind of knew really early on that that was what I wanted to do, even though I was kind of chasing a dream that I didn't know if it was a reality back then or not, because being a professional women's football player didn't exist as such. So thankfully for me, it all worked out in the end.
And it's interesting how fast things have moved, Simone, isn't it? Because people years ago wouldn't have contemplated this as being a personality, a possibility, because it just wasn't available to women.
No, not at all. Like, all of my role models when I was growing up were the male players. You know, women were playing, but there was no accessibility. There was nowhere for me to watch it or know about anything that was happening. But yeah, in the last few years, the speed that the game's growing, and it's still continuing to grow, and it's fantastic to be a part of it.
It makes you wonder why it took so long.
Yeah, no, I know. I think things, obviously, if I look back to, you know, the 2012 Olympics and how well Team GB did, etc. then, and a lot of money and funding kind of came from there. And then the success of some of the home nations, and even if I look at ourselves qualifying for the last European championship, I think things like that have massively helped in terms of people becoming interested, and then obviously funding, which is massive for what we're trying to do.
And you became the first female footballer from Northern Ireland to play for a Premier League. You signed full-time Everton in 2017. How big was that at the time?
Yeah, I thought it was massive. Obviously, like you said, no one from Northern Ireland had done that before, and I was very young at the time. And
must have been scary going over there.
Yeah, very much so. I was only sort of 17, just turned 18. And there was no real clear pathway. You know, if you look at, if you're a young boy, there's very much a clear pathway into the professional game. But for being a young female, there wasn't one. And I tried to figure out a pathway and make one up at the time, because it didn't exist. And for me, that was trying to move across the water and sign with a Premier League club. And that's what I did in signing with Everton. But I had to obviously do that alongside going to university, which is very different than that of a male if they were to take the step across the water. So, yeah, it was very daunting at the time. But obviously for me, it was a massive step in my career. And, you know, for young girls in Northern Ireland, a monumental moment that someone did that. And hopefully it inspired a lot of people to want to do the same.
Does it wind you up, the difference in wages between men and women? And again,
yeah, it's something that obviously is kind of, there's been a lot of noise around that for quite some time. And yeah, I think obviously the men's game is at a level where the money is absurd. And I think, you know, we're very much still growing our game. And obviously the more revenue that we can make in our game, then I think there is more of an argument for us to, you know, make better money and the wages can grow. So yeah, we'll see where it goes.
And you're heading back to your first club, Miss Middlesir Ladies. What will you be doing there?
Yeah, so I'm heading over today, back to my old club, through the Chase Football coaching programme. So they've obviously, they're funding a lot of grassroots coaching courses. So I'm going back. Obviously, my brother is very much involved with the club. My little niece plays. So it's a real family affair going back. And yeah, just talking about the work that Chase are doing and the opportunities that they're going to provide for people like my brother and all the community coaches that are involved in the game.
That was your brother got you into football, is that right?
Yeah, it was. He was the reason I started playing all them years ago. He obviously played. And I just kind of went along to see what the fuss was all about and fell in love with the game so early on, and then it became my dream.
Well, well done for fulfilling some of your dreams, and I'm sure you'll continue to do so, Simone. And thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, everyone, for listening this morning. That's Monday done as we edge closer to this American election. We'll see what happens tomorrow. See you at 9. Bye-bye.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.